You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. I remember trying on my sister's braces when I was a child and how I early learned to pounce on other kids who used the term cripple as a derogatory. My sister contracted polio when she was six, and in ways even a six-year-old like me could perceive, that made our family different. It made my parents' lives difficult in ways they could not have foreseen when they longed for their first child. As Andrew Solomon writes, "If you have a child with a disability, you are forever the parent of a disabled child. It is one of the primary facts about you, fundamental to the way other people perceive and decipher you." One can be different in so many different ways, as Andrew Solomon makes clear in his extraordinarily eloquent, compassionate, and deeply profound Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, a book that, as Dwight Garner wrote in the New York Times, shoots arrow after arrow into your heart. Reading this book is, for many, a life-changing experience, and Andrew deserves abundant gratitude from our society at large for having written it, as evident in the many awards bestowed upon this work: a National Book Critics Circle Award, the Books for a Better Life Award, and many, many others. Solomon is also the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and winner of the 2001 National Book Award, and he's also the author of the critically acclaimed novel, A Stone Boat. Andrew's in conversation tonight with Tom Kerwin, one of the most admired writers, certainly one of the ones I most admire at the Los Angeles Times. Many of Tom's features have covered the concept of difference, among them his deeply moving series on a young woman living with neurofibromatosis. He's received an Academy of American Poets Prize, a Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism, and in 2008, he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. We're going to start tonight with a clip which talks about Andrew's work, and we'll roll it now, and then we'll welcome our guests. Roll it, Russell. Thank you, and please welcome Andrew Solomon and Tom Kerwin.
Well, good evening. Isn't that a beautiful clip? I think it just sets the tone for this conversation so nicely. We're going to have a conversation up here for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to questions. And so please keep your thoughts in mind as we turn to the audience to get your thoughts on what we're talking about up here. Far From the Tree is such a big, such an ambitious book that we have a lot of ground to cover this evening. So what I thought I'd like to do to start things off is to just try to set up some sort of context for our conversation here. So I think the first question that I'd like to ask you, Andrew, is to have you just talk a little bit about the distinctions between identity and illness, or illness and identity as you take it through the chronology of past to present, as a way of sort of understanding what you've described as the most essential element, the most essential question that this book raises.
So I'll just start by saying what a pleasure it is to be here and how thrilled I am that so many people can turn out on a Tuesday night to hear about something like this. The question of illness and identity runs very deep throughout my book. The point of origin for the book really was an assignment that I got in 1994 to write about deaf culture. The first deaf person I really got to know was Jackie Roth, who's in the film. I went out into the deaf culture, and I had, prior to the assignment, assumed that deafness was simply a disability, that it was a grave misfortune, that it must be terribly difficult for people who couldn't hear, and what could we do to help them? And then I became involved in the deaf world, and I went to deaf clubs, and I went to deaf theater, and I went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, where people complained about slurry Southern signing. And I really got into the idea that there was a deaf culture, and I thought it is a culture. It's a culture united by the shared use of sign language, and it's quite a beautiful culture, and though I don't ultimately wish that I were part of it because I think it also carries many difficulties and because it simply isn't my culture, I had moments when I was with deaf people and I thought, oh, I wish I were deaf too. I wish I were part of this world that they inhabit. And then I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents. And when I had that discovery, I thought how similar their situation was to the experience of gay people who are born to straight parents. And I felt that when I was growing up, gayness was certainly considered an illness. There was no question. It was a crime, it was a sin, and it was a mental illness that required intensive intervention. And it was somehow a basic failure of one's humanity. And in my adulthood, being gay functions as an identity. And I saw that for the deaf people I was interviewing, they had what I had perceived until I started spending time with them to be an illness and what they experienced by and large as an identity. And I ultimately formulated the idea, which is central to the book, that almost any characteristic can be described in negative terms as an illness and in positive terms as an identity, so that you can actually find, in a sense, an illness model for all kinds of things that we don't think of as illnesses and that really aren't illnesses. But you can say there are times when it's disabling to be very young or to be very old. There are contexts in which it's disabling to be American. There are contexts in which it's disabling to be Jewish. There are all kinds of ways that one may be that can be disabling in all kinds of contexts. And I said that also, it turns out that you can find an identity model for a lot of things we think of as perilous illnesses. So I came to think, for example, that when my mother was dying of cancer, that her illness became in some way her identity, and that a lot of our emotional life was oriented around the sense in which she came to achieve ownership of the prospect of her own demise. And so I wanted in this book to say, these are fluid categories. There are things we now think of as illnesses that in 50 years we'll think of as identities. I don't know quite what they are, but I know that they're there. And there are things that we used to think of as illnesses that we now think of as identities, and things we used to think of as identities that we now think of as illnesses. It's a very fluid category. And you can have the same condition. There can be one deaf person for whom deafness is primarily a severe disability and creates a life that's miserable and constrained, and another person for whom deafness becomes an identity and the basis for all of their dignity. And you can say it about gayness, and you can say it about most of the other categories I looked at in the book.
And what's so poignant about this book is the portraits of the parents who are coming to some very sort of basic, trying to answer some very basic questions about their child and how they're going to relate to their child. A lot of projection, a lot of transference that they put upon these kids as they perhaps have come to consider the world as not as flexible as we would like to think it is, as they try to protect their children against what they feel is sort of a perilous environment for differences. I guess the question that I'm wondering is, as these parents found their way, I was struck by, as I was reading the book, whether I would be able to be as brave and as courageous towards their children as they currently are. And I wonder if that question crossed your mind as you're living with these people, as you're reporting on them, and as you're spending time with them. Did you ever sort of wonder about yourself and your capability to love as unconditionally as these parents seem to be able to?
I wondered about it all the time. There is no question that I chose mostly to write about people I admire. There are people in the book who did, in fact, give up their children or who said that they regretted having the children they had. But I was mostly interested in how people construct meaning. And, of course, people who have constructed meaning are also more interested in talking to a journalist than people who have rejected their own children. But as I went out into that world, it was very humbling. But I thought there was a moment that, to me, was very telling about this phenomenon altogether, which is that there's a woman who has a daughter who has dwarfism, for whom that was a very difficult adjustment, but she made the adjustment, and dwarfism again, illness, identity, it can function either way. And she was describing to me how she got into the elevator at, I think it was Johns Hopkins Hospital, and she said she got on the elevator holding her young daughter, and she said this other woman got in holding a daughter who had Down syndrome, and Lisa, the mother I was interviewing, said, and I just looked at her and I thought, well, I figured out how to deal with mine, but I could never deal with yours. She said, and then I looked up and realized she was looking at me the exact same way. And I think that's frequently what I came to, is that none of these parents would have thought that they could achieve this kind of compassionate engagement, and quite miraculously they all did. And I found that this research, rather than making me think parenthood was frightening, look at all the things that could go wrong, made me think that parenthood actually could encompass extraordinary things and that love could thrive within families, even under very unlikely circumstances. It was very inspiring.
What do you mean when you say construct meaning?
I think that there's always the question when someone is confronted with any major difficulty, but especially when parents are confronted with difficulties of the kinds that I was chronicling. There's always the question of whether you're going to say this is a tragedy or whether you're going to say this has been given to us for a purpose and we can learn from it. Now, some people say it's been given to us for a purpose because they have religious beliefs that strongly support that position. But one of the mothers I interviewed said, rather wonderfully, I thought, she said, I think actually it's not believing in God that allowed us to recognize that children like ours are not a gift for some inherent reason, but because that's what we have chosen. I think always of Ovid having said, welcome this pain for you will learn from it. And I feel a lot of the parents ultimately said, we would not have chosen to have children with these challenges, but having had those children and having become deeply attached to them, as most parents ultimately become deeply attached to most of their children, they were able to say that they really loved those children and that they wouldn't want to have other children instead. They might like their children not to face certain challenges, but they were very attached to those children themselves.
Yeah. It's the picture that comes across. So I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. So to lay out a little bit more of the organization of the book here, you say you began this with a project with the New York Times back in the early 90s or so.
Right.
So you've been living with this book for about 20 years. I guess what I'm thinking about is
don't laugh.
20 years and 11 years of writing it.
Yes.
And you've been on the book tour for 11 months now. So this is a man with a lot of stamina. So I wanted to get a sense of how you began to think about organizing this material. Perhaps share some of the categories that you settled upon, any that you did not think about.
I considered at least 30 or 40 different possible chapter topics and in the end restrained myself to 10 chapters about other people's differences and an introduction about being a gay child of straight parents and a conclusion about being a gay father, what somebody described to me as the Andrew sandwich. The categories that I ended up doing were a chapter on parents of deaf children, parents of dwarves, families of people with Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities, families of prodigies, because I wanted to demonstrate that what's challenging is having a child who's different, even if the difference is positively constructed, families bringing up children conceived in rape, so that I could look at the idea that the impediments to parental bonding can have to do not only with the inherent qualities of the child, but also with where the child came from and how the advent of the child relates to the psychic progression of the parent. A chapter on families of people who commit crimes, to look at the idea that, again, these challenges could come from what the children did rather than from what the children obviously and inherently were, and a chapter on families of people who are transgender. As I tried to narrow down to my list of 10, there were a number of considerations that were operative. One was that I wanted to ensure that I didn't write too repetitively. So the experience of blind people is very different from the experience of deaf people, but there was enough overlap so that I felt I didn't need to do a deaf chapter and a blind chapter back to back. Lots to be done with the blind, but I didn't put it in there. I also wanted to have the first half of the book, the first six of those categories I mentioned, that were clearly disease entities, and the last four things that appear to be more socially constructed, to try to look at the different aspects of this whole problem or question of difference. And in a strange way, I put the prodigies in to cheer myself up in the middle of this whole thing. And then it turned out that the big surprise about having a child with Down syndrome or autism or schizophrenia is that actually it can be a rich and rewarding experience. And the big surprise about having a child who's a prodigy is that actually it can drive you completely around the bend. So that came into it. But those were really the sort of focusing instincts. And I wish, people write to me all the time now and say, if only you'd done a chapter about people like me, if only you'd done a chapter about this or that, I wish I could have done more. It's quite a chunky book as it is, so I had to draw the line somewhere. I did have a letter recently from someone who wrote to me and said, you covered so many categories, but I wish, and he was writing entirely in earnest, I wish you had written more about an experience such as mine, which is the difficulty you have if you are a dog person and your son is not a dog person.
Perhaps I'm reminded, as I was preparing to talk with you over the weekend, I had a chance to spend some time on the website Far From the Tree.
Ah.
It's a really great website, by the way, so I would recommend that not only you buy the book, but you also spend some time going through the various stories presented on the website. But what's interesting is the community that's been sort of gathered, really nicely put together in under one of the tabs of the website. As you're making this tour, and as you're 11 months out there talking to people, this community, as it sort of circled around you in some interesting way, are you providing a voice for obviously people who have not had this voice before?
The website was an enormous project, and it was in fact for the website that I started filming interviews with the people I'd talked to for the book, and ultimately I patched some of those together into the trailer that you've just seen, or rather the person who helped produce the trailer patched them together, but that was our idea. It's been great having the website because it's given people a chance to tell their stories. There's a section of it called Community Voices in which everybody can write up their stories, and then there's space for people to comment on one another's stories, and there are a lot of people who've now told me that they posted the story and they got helpful information or it led somewhere else. I was very aware in working on the book altogether that it's a book that would have been impossible in the era before the internet, because what it really describes is how people find the identity model rather than the illness model through finding community. And while there are some of these arenas in which there was community earlier on, there's been a deaf culture for a long time, there are many of them in which community has been contingent on people being able to go online and find one another. And when I hear the stories of families who had, for example, a child with diastrophic dwarfism, when Clinton Brown, who has that condition, was born, it was a sort of hopeless story. And there was no way to get any other information. His mother said, "We got one paragraph in a medical textbook, one paragraph about what the whole rest of our lives were going to be like." Now, you go online and you type in diastrophic dwarfism, you can meet other people who have it, you can find out what the research is on it, and so on and so forth. So there is much more of a sense of community. The thing that was most striking to me as I worked on the book was that so many people seemed willing to tell me stories that appeared to be agonizing for them to relate. And at some point, I would say to people, just tell me why you decided to tell me your story, given how difficult this clearly is for you. And time after time after time, people would say, I felt so alone in these experiences as I was having them. And if my telling my story will help others to feel less alone, then I'm really glad to be able to do that. And the website has been a place for people to do that. The web in general is a place for people to do that. And that construction of community, I think, is absolutely central to the mission, the ideology, and the research for the book.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see the book as sort of a tent under which people can all sort of gather and find their own sort of portions of their community underneath that tent.
I think also, I'll just say on that front, that to me, the central underlying idea of the book is that difference is what unites us. That's become sort of my tagline. But it's that each of these kinds of differences taken by itself seems quite isolating. They're rather siloed. You know, families of people with schizophrenia, families bring up children conceived and raped, families of people with Down syndrome, families of criminals. There aren't so many families in any of those categories, and in a way, the world in which those families operate can become narrow. But I found that the process of negotiating the fact of difference between the parents and the child, of having a child who represented a challenge to the expectations the parents had had before having children, is a near universal. Not always in such extreme terms, but it is still something that most families, you know, most people at some point look at their children and wonder where on earth they came from. And I really felt that in looking at the situations of these more extreme parents, that there was, my hope was to build and to establish some degree of community so that people could understand from one of these conditions to another. And I was deeply moved by, before I had finished the book, and I wrote a little bit about it in the book, by an interview that was done with one of the Republican state senators in New York State who came out in support of gay marriage. And he was interviewed by someone who said, "Why did you change your position on this? You'd been a social conservative. Where did this come from?" And he said, I have an autistic grandson, and it changed my thinking about a lot of things. And I thought, oh, there really is this sense, if you have experienced one of these things, you can understand the others.
That's a very powerful story. It's funny, I wanted to ask this question, but you've sort of already answered it in terms of how you were able to sustain yourself during this project. And in the clip, you talk about how you had to prepare yourself for looking at all these desperate situations. I mean, as you're putting together this list of your various chapter heads, you're looking at dwarfism, you're looking at autism, Down syndrome, rape, and you're thinking this is going to be... And if you're familiar with Andrew's writing, he's not one to take this over lightly. Each of these chapters is almost a book unto itself, with a history and with really great sort of storytelling that drives you through this book. But I guess at the onset, how did you prepare yourself for these sort of desperate situations that you anticipated getting involved in?
I really started with the deaf experience, and I had already had the experience of meeting a lot of deaf people and having my assumption that their lives were inherently tragic, challenged, very fundamentally. And some of the conditions I wrote about are easier, and some of them are harder. People always say, what's the hardest, what's the best? There are people who found meaning in all kinds of difficult situations. There are people who have struggled to find meaning in situations that seem more straightforward. There were some chapters that were incredibly difficult to do. I mean, I think the chapter on children conceived in rape, I kept hearing the stories that were told by these women. There are people who will say, my child is deaf, it opened up a whole world to me, I'm incredibly thrilled I had this child, I wouldn't want it any other way. I met people who said, I love the child I had as a result of a rape, and I would not wish to imagine a life without my child. But I didn't meet anyone who said that they were glad that they had been raped. So it depended on the chapter. I think a lot of what I discovered was that there were people who were so besotted with their own children and with who those children were. I mean, I always think of a moment that to me sort of crystallized it. There was a family of a child with multiple very severe disabilities who couldn't walk, who couldn't talk, who in some ways, you know, would seem to a casual observer to be nearly inert. His family, however, was deeply committed to him and very involved, and this child died tragically through caregiver neglect. And at the interment of his ashes, his mother said, let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the son I wanted and once of the child I loved. And that contrast was always there. And so I think people thought it sounded very depressing, and it had very depressing moments, and I looked at very difficult situations. But there was also a lot of transcendence, and it wasn't just that I came in and sort of gloriously wanted to impose that transcendence. It really, there was a lot of transcendence that people wanted to talk to me about, and that was very sustaining. So I sometimes felt a little bit like an oncologist. I remember once talking to whom I said, how can you deal? He dealt with people with very late stage cancers. How can you deal with losing so many people? And he said, because of the ones I save. And I think I could deal with these very difficult stories because I also found these extraordinary moments of redemption. But having said that, there were interviews that I did for the book, and I went home and went to bed for 3 days because I was so overwhelmed by what people had been struggling with, and because there was so much darkness in their own experience and in the way they had been treated by the larger world in many cases, especially for the people who were transgender. So it was a balance. And it took 11 years, partly because I interviewed a lot of people and it was a lot of material to synthesize, but also partly because there were periods when I would think I have to just step back from it for a few weeks and breathe a little bit before I go back into this.
Mm-hmm. I was very struck by just how profoundly articulate these parents are. Dylan Klebold's mother, who told you that she would want to tell him, ask his forgiveness for not knowing what was going on inside of his life, for the woman in Rwanda, who at the end of your interviews, that's a good story. You're in Rwanda talking about women who'd been raped and the children that they bore. And this one woman turned to you and what was it? She asked you a question.
I'd been in Rwanda at that point for about 10 days. I'd been interviewing all of these women. Those stories were so beyond appalling as to be genuinely unimaginable. And I, when I did those interviews, tended at the end of them to say, and do you have any questions for me? Which slightly redresses the enormous power imbalance between a sort of foreign journalist who's come in and people who are often in an abject situation. And most of the women I'd met had asked questions like, will this be published in French? Are you going to use my real name? How long will you stay in Rwanda? Questions like that. There's one woman, unbelievably beautiful Tutsi woman, who had been raped in the genocide, had this child of rape, and was now living living and taking care of this child. I said to her, do you have any questions for me? And she said, well, you're in this field of psychology, right? And I said, yes, more or less. And she said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? Because I want to love her so much. But when I look at her, I think about what happened to me, and it gets in the way. And I was so startled that I was kind of frozen, and I just stood there staring at her. And she said it again very sort of intensely. She said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And it was only actually a few weeks later, as I kept thinking and thinking about it, that I realized how much love there was in that question itself.
Do you remember how you responded to her there? Because I was thinking to myself that as you're writing this book and as you're gathering all these stories and as each story is giving a little bit another piece to this puzzle that you're putting together, these families probably turned to you for advice. They probably turned to you and asked you, who else have you talked to? What else have you learned from other autistic families or et cetera? So, I mean, do you recall how you responded or how you react when people ask for such advice?
In that particular instant in Rwanda, I think I reacted clumsily, and I sort of said, you know, you just keep trying, I don't know. I was so taken aback by it. Most of the interviews for the book, I mean, almost all of them were in the United States. There were sort of two little sections in foreign cultures, which I can explain at some point, but mostly they were in the US or a few in the UK. And I did find people over and over again asking me for advice. And I've never really held with the rigorous idea that the neutral journalist should not have any effect on the people he's writing about. I always thought that if I actually met a family that was dealing with a grave difficulty and I knew another family that had been successful in dealing with it, that it was sort of a moral imperative if these people were going to open up their lives to me, tell me their stories, share their tribulations, to let them know what I could about ways there were to help. So I put a lot of families in touch with one another in the course of what I was doing. I told a lot of people about the resources that I had found. You know, I wouldn't say that I transformed anyone's lives beyond recognition, but, and I gave them a sense, I think somehow, despite what I said earlier about the internet, the sense that there were other people with similar conditions. Right. And a lot of the time, people expressed enormous relief. Someone would say to me, I have felt X about my child. You know, I've struggled with the feeling, I mean, I was one family in particular, I remember someone said, I struggled with the feeling of thinking it would have been better if he had died in childbirth than that he had grown up with these challenges, which are very severe challenges. And I remember the man who said that to me, and he wept when he said it, and he said, has anyone else said that to you? And I said, actually, yes, several other people have said more or less the same thing, and several people have talked about that idea and said, but however, now if they were to lose the child, it would be a grave loss. And he said, that's just how I feel. And he was so visibly relieved by the idea that he wasn't the only one and that the thoughts he had didn't constitute some grave evil. So,
These stories of how isolated these families and these children are with their disability and what they're struggling with has just raised a question in my mind about why do you suppose there's such a need to stigmatize differences and to put them in such a corner of our lives? And because, I mean, perhaps we're just all too, you know, too much of the 2013 right now, of a certain mindset that we want to be able to think about acceptance and celebrate diversity. But clearly this is an anomaly when it comes to the broad span of time. So it takes me to the notion of stigma. It takes me to the notion of why these differences have been so threatening to us that we've needed to isolate these people. Is it self-perpetuating on their behalf to some extent? Or clearly society does its own turn. But have you thought about that as you work through this material?
I could just say no and move on.
Yes, no, we'd be that would be perfectly fair. perfectly fair. That was a question off the script here, so I have to be curious.
Absolutely. No, I've thought about it all the time. I've thought about it very deeply and profoundly. You know, I've had this experience of being part of a group that was intensely stigmatized when I was a kid and is much less intensely stigmatized now, at least in the world I live in. And when I've done my public speaking gigs, I've frequently quoted this passage from Time magazine, The Voice of Mainstream America, in 1966 when I was 3 years old. And they wrote, there is, even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no glamorization, no rationalization, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness. And I look at that as the voice of mainstream America, and I look at a year in which both the President of the United States and the Supreme Court have expressed support for gay marriage. And I think, how on earth did we make that transition? And my feeling really is that there has been a movement which has historical roots but kicked into gear in the early 20th century toward the liberation of people who were oppressed in various ways and toward the acceptance of difference. So the women's suffrage movement, I think, was the thing that set the original model, not that it didn't draw on previous things, but that really set the original model for the idea that this part of the population that had been marginalized actually deserved to have rights that were in some sense equal to those of the population that had been marginalizing. And then there was the racial civil rights movement, and I think without Martin Luther King, we wouldn't have any of the other rights movements we have in the same way, or without the entire period of that civil rights movement. And then the gay rights movement drew on the language of the civil rights movement. The tendency has been somehow for people who are in any movement that is just gaining its liberty to associate themselves very energetically with the movement toward liberty that came before. So a lot of gay rights activists have said, we're just like the civil rights people, and some of the civil rights people have been uncomfortable with that, the civil rights people, whoever one means by that. But I mean, leaders in the civil rights movement, some of them were uncomfortable with the idea that gay people were saying that gay people were just the same as black people. How could you say that? There were all of these differences, so on and so forth. I felt as though I lived in a category that had become destigmatized. And instead of simply affiliating myself with other categories of people who had achieved a relief from stigma, I wanted to see who is stigmatized, who might actually make this transition next. And I felt that it was all of these communities of difference, positive, negative, complicated, disease, illness, identity, whatever they were, all of these categories where I thought there was the potential for that shift to take place. And I think that the change in stigma relies on three levels of acceptance. It relies on people achieving self-acceptance, it relies on family acceptance, and it relies on social acceptance. And I became interested in families because I think they mediate between the individual and the larger society and have an enormously determinative role, though obviously all three influence one another. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, the category that does not have so much of a stigma in your book, the chapter that I found intriguing in its own right, was the one on prodigies. Temple Grandin's great line about genius is its own form of disability.
Yes.
So that was a chapter that I was drawn to, but I'm interested in when you think about this book of yours. Is there a particular chapter that you in your mind keep going back to and one that you keep revisiting in your mind whose stories speak to you the most eloquently?
Really, in the course of 11 years, I grew deeply engaged with all of these areas and all of these communities, and I find myself, I mean, I still have friends from every one of the chapters. There are people who I interviewed once and we had a great conversation, that was it. But there are people I've kept closely in touch with from each chapter. And so I'm involved in the lives of people who are negotiating these various things. The chapter on prodigies, as I said at the beginning, I put in partly because I wanted to look at the idea that it's difference that's challenging. And what I found was that in the same way that it's difficult to have the mind of a 6-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old, it's rather difficult to have the mind of a 30-year-old in the body of a 6-year-old. And a lot of the time, the parents were dealing with the same problem as in the other chapters, which was asynchrony, the sense that their child either spent time with intellectual peers who were uninterested in someone at that stage of life, or with age peers who had no idea what the person was talking about. And I found that for a lot of those families, having a child who's a prodigy is less sad than having a child who's massively disabled. but it's not any easier. It requires the same entry into a new community, learning a whole new system of ways that things function, the mental health risk that can be associated with having extraordinary, premature, precocious development in music or intellectually altogether can be enormous. There's the same sense that often there's a weird dynamic which echoes dynamics that exist in disability between the parents who are trying to figure out how to respond to this child who is incomprehensible and the parents who are in some ways exploiting a child and trying to make him into something he isn't. That tension of who is the child really, what are the parents doing? It just, the parallels were very persistent for me. So, and I loved the fact that some of the people who were interviewed for the chapter who said to me, I don't really understand what I'm doing in this book as you describe it, have since said that they really do see the parallels. And the mother of one of the prodigies, who didn't particularly know the rest of what I was doing, but whom I was interviewing, I mean, she knew the general idea, but we were talking about Drew Peterson. We were talking about the experience of his brother and what it was like for his brother to have a sibling who is such an extraordinarily accomplished musician at such an early age and who has played very, very beautifully. And his mother said, I think it's very much what it would have been like if his brother had had a wooden leg, in terms of the amount of energy and attention it took, the amount of confusion, the amount of accommodation it required from the entire family. So I ended up seeing it all. It fit together rather neatly in the end.
I'm most intrigued at that moment that occurs in these families' lives when they suddenly have sort of an about face towards their child's disability. For instance, I'm currently working on a story about a young man with autism, and as the autistic community knows, it's very common for these families to be running out and doing whatever they can under the quickest amount of time to see if they can get their child into the therapy, get them under hormones, get them under a gluten-free diet, do whatever they can to curb the encroaching autistic symptoms. But then, in this one particular family's case, it's extraordinary the moment when suddenly that transition, suddenly that fighting against that diagnosis seems to sort of stop, and that moment of acceptance begins, sort of a road to Damascus kind of moment, when suddenly they recognize the fact that this isn't something that I have to fight so much against. It's something that I can actually incorporate into my life.
I think that really draws on a central experience in parenting in general. Parenting involves two impulses which don't always correlate very well. One is that we change our children. We educate them, we try to teach them values, we teach them to brush their teeth, we do all kinds of things. We don't leave children in a state of nature. Parenthood is precisely about not leaving your child in a state of nature. It's about doing all these other things instead. But it's also important for parents to accept their children for who they are and not to make their children feel inadequate in their basic selves. Now, there are some areas in which it's very obvious that you want to change things. There are some areas in which it's very obvious that your child is who he is and you simply need to accept it. And then there's an enormous range of stuff in the middle in which it's not clear whether the thing you need to do is to say, you're fantastic being exactly the way you are and I'm just going to make the most of it, or saying, come on, let's see if we can fix this and make things better. And that stuff in the middle territory can be very difficult to negotiate. And for a lot of these parents, they started off thinking, I have a child with autism and I need to make the autism go away. And I'm going to try every single treatment that's out there and my child is going to be one of those miracle children who gets better. And autism is especially tricky because there are some people who seem early to have rather severe autism and who end up being highly functional and well integrated. And there are other people who never seem to shift in their sensibility in any way. I mean, it's a very mixed prognosis for people with autism. But a lot of the time, there is a moment when the family finally says, actually, we aren't going to be able to fix this. And if we aren't going to be able to fix it, then we should learn how to make some kind of reasonable peace with it. And that reasonable peace sometimes actually blossoms into, as in the case of the young man you were describing, a kind of celebration of who the child really is.
And what the family can be.
Yes.
And that, I think, is that great moment when suddenly...
And that the family, I was just going to say, and that the family not only finds meaning, you know, it's not just that the parents find meaning for themselves, it's that the parents then think, oh, part of my job is to help this child to find meaning in his own difference. And while parents can't entirely do that, they can help a lot in that direction.
Yeah, that was one question as I was reading this book, is just understanding. I mean, we talk a lot about this from the parent's point of view, but certainly from the child's point of view. The pain of a child who is facing the disapproval of the parent, the pain of the child who's not being accepted by the parent, who can read in the parent's look the disapproval of the choices or the quality or character that they are. I mean, this is what I find, so it's such a complicated dynamic between parent and child, and that need for acceptance and that tension between whether you can be accepted by your parents or whether you can't. I was interested in this book too, the role that faith plays in these families and helping them make that transition. Or perhaps it wasn't ever a transition to begin with because they had that faith to start with. What did you come to understand about the role that faith played in helping parents accept their children?
I saw that there were parents who responded very readily to these challenges because, as I said earlier, they thought God had a purpose for them in what they were experiencing. I found that there were people who spoke about suddenly having a sense of a need for religion. There was one mother, for example, who described having never been very religious, deciding when her son was 3 months old she was going to have him baptized, and running in and telling her husband, we have to do this right away. And she said she didn't know why it was at the time, and afterwards she said it was because I needed to prove to myself that he had a soul and that he was a human being. And that was a way of formalizing that and announcing it. What I saw overall was that faith could be the locus of extraordinary charity, perhaps the greatest charity and kindness and generosity and acceptance, and that faith could also be the place of the most bigotry, intolerance, and cruelty. And the chapter in which that opposition surfaced most significantly was the chapter on people who are transgender, where I had on the one hand the story of a woman I interviewed who had adopted 3 children, all with very severe disabilities because they were siblings and they had been abused by their mother, who was schizophrenic but fed them her antipsychotics instead of taking them herself. It's a terrible story. Anyway, she adopted these children, one of whom ultimately proved to be transgender. She lived in a small town in Tennessee, and when she went and told the school that her child would be attending school as a different gender the next year, she began getting calls from the members of the dominant Baptist church in her town, threatening to kill her and to kill her child and take that child and make a real woman out of her if that's what she wants, and so on and so forth. And there were these horrifying calls, and she eventually got a call from the pediatrician who said, I was at church and we were not discussing whether... The people there were not discussing whether to kill your child. They were discussing when to do it and what to use for that purpose. And if you're interested in your child's survival, you'd better get out of town right away. And she packed her children into a car, drove off, went and lived in another city under an assumed name where nobody knew who she was, couldn't get a job doing what she'd been doing, ended up cleaning restaurants at McDonald's. The day after she left, her husband had stayed behind. The day after she left, they came and... They disemboweled the family dog and nailed it to a fence in front of the house to indicate what would happen to their child. And then there's the story of Kim Reed, who is the transgender woman who was in the film earlier, who made a film about the experience of being transgender and about going back to her 20th high school reunion. She had been the quarterback on her high school football team when she was a man named Paul. My favorite moment in the film is when one of the... other people is chatting at the reunion and says, but Kim, we've all changed. But Kim, in any case, came back to a reunion, and then she made this film, and then she got a call from the pastor of the church where she'd grown up in Helena, Montana, who said, we'd like to show the film at church. And Kim said, well, I don't live in Helena, Montana. My mom lives in Helena, Montana, so it's up to her. And her mother said, I knew the film would come to town one way or another anyway, and I thought better in the church than anywhere else. And they ended up having a weekend in which on Friday they showed the film, and on Saturday they They had seminars to discuss the issues that it had brought up. And on Sunday, Kim was invited to preach the sermon at church. And she had a completely packed house. The pastor told me that she had never seen the church more full except for Christmas or Easter. It was sort of standing room only. And when she finished giving this sermon about the prodigal son, but the idea of being welcomed back after having gone into a distant country and done unknowable things, when she finished her sermon, the entire church stood up and gave her a standing ovation. And the feeling of embrace and the feeling, as one of the people said, if she's had those difficult conversations with herself, the least we can do is have them with her, was one of the most inspiring experiences I had in working on the book.
Wow, what a transition from dogs being disemboweled to that.
Yeah.
Wow. So it leads me to wonder, we were told in this clip that there is no definition for normal. How would you define normal? How would you like to see normal defined?
I'd sort of like to do away with the whole idea of normal entirely. I think that an enormous number of people, I think almost everyone differs significantly from their own idea of normal, and that most people have a sense of inadequacy and woe attached to those deviations. And I think that that frequently plays out in a tragic fashion within people's lives. There was a lot of argument against the Human Genome Project from the disability community on grounds that the Human Genome Project implied that there was a correct genome and that you could then measure everyone's variations from it. And they pointed out that there's nobody who really has that correct genome. Now, I don't want to get into the sort of subtleties of genetics as a science, but I think the basic idea that everybody is constantly thinking, I should be hewing closer to the norm is dangerous, and the idea that people think others should be hewing closer to the norm is oppressive. And I think it ends up, the idea of normal, damaging people because of the way they see themselves and damaging the way that they interact with other people. I really went into this book partly because I have some counterphobic tendencies, fear of heights, so I went skydiving, disabled people made me kind of uncomfortable, so I wrote this book. You know, it's a little bit lunatic, but I really found it was amazing how many people, I went to my first WARF convention, and I could feel sort of, you know, my irony thing going up to sort of make all kinds of jokes about it. And then a lot of the people I was looking at ended up being friends of mine. And I have to say, when I started working on people who are transgender, I thought that was really pretty far out there. And now some of those people likewise are friends of mine. And I just feel the more that one can let go of that idea of normal, the better one can do. You mentioned Sue Klebold, the mother of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre. And I loved something that she said to me. She said she worked in a building in which there was also a parole office. And she said, before Columbine happened, she said, I would shrink into the corner of the elevator when the people got on who were going up to the parole office, she said, because I was so afraid of them. She said, and after it happened, I thought, they're somebody's children, and they're not so different from what my own son was like. And I said hello to them when they got on the elevator. She said, so even though what happened was so awful, she said, in that regard, it was liberating that I no longer thought that they were different from me. And I thought that was really the message of the book. Even the most horrific thing can break down that sense of normality and be a vast liberation.
That's beautiful. Nice. Nice. I have one more question, and then we'll open it up to you all. So what I find so entertaining and wonderful about your books is you're bringing in your own personal story, The Noonday Demon and now Far From the Tree. In the final chapter of Far From the Tree, you and your husband have a baby boy. And at that moment in the delivery room, you had a bit of a scare when you were wondering whether your child was going to be, how do we put it, normal or not. But very, very human. I mean, this is what's so great about this book is that Andrew owns up to his own sort of questioning and his own sort of humanity in the course of understanding the subject and the book himself. But in the course of in that moment, you're waiting for the results to come back, and you ask yourself, the question you ask yourself, how do I love, no, not how, do I love this baby? I thought that was such an amazing moment in the book. Profoundly honest, a difficult question to ask. Can you talk about that a little bit? Was that a moment of sort of naive distancing, perhaps? I don't know if that's not quite the right word, but is that a moment of distancing, a sense that you don't have any choice whether you're going to love this child or not, but you ask that question anyway?
So our son was born, and the day after he was born, the pediatrician came in and said that she was concerned because he wasn't extending his legs correctly, which she said could reflect brain damage, because insofar as he was extending them, he was doing so asymmetrically, which she said could reflect a mass in his brain, and because he had a large head, and she thought he should be tested for hydrocephalus. And there I found myself having worked on this book about how much meaning people found in the experience of having disabled children, and suddenly I was confronting this possibility myself. And like all parents, time out of mind, I wanted to protect my child, and I didn't want him to be disabled. But the point that I think you're talking about is that I felt that I didn't want him to be disabled for two reasons. One was that I didn't want this poor little newborn to suffer. And the other was that I had seen how much work it is to be the parent of such a child, and I wasn't sure if I was up for it or if I would be able to do it. And I didn't have, I must say as a parent, I know people who've said, the second I beheld my child, I suddenly knew that my whole destiny in life were with this child. And I loved my children, and if they had told me that day, you have to give up your kidney in order for him to survive, or even both your kidney, you know, I would happily have done it because I knew that that was what should be done. But I didn't have this sense of sort of overpowering adoration. It set in for me gradually over a course of time. And in that first day, I found myself thinking to myself, what am I prepared to go through? But I knew that I had agreed to do this thing. I had decided to have a child. We'd gone about it very deliberately. And that if I had a child who had a difference, I would have to engage with that child. And my question, in a way, wasn't so much, do I love him, though that was part of it. It was the feeling that I must already love him, because I found myself, when all this stuff came up, trying to distance myself. And I thought, how can I be distancing myself from this person who I just met 6 hours ago? But already there was the sense that there was that bond that required required distancing. But most fundamentally, I was looking at the idea that if he was going to have one of these differences, that would be his identity. And if that was going to be his identity, it was going to be my identity. And that was going to be an enormous and overwhelming and complicated adjustment. Parenting altogether is an enormous adjustment. That was going to be a huge adjustment. And I had to keep wondering whether I would have the strength that these parents had had. But it was the odd feeling it's one's fate is so bound up in someone over whom already we had no control over what was happening to him. He was strapped into the MRI machine. He went for a CAT scan. He had an arterial blood draw. All of these procedures were happening. And I had a feeling really of despair about it, but also the knowledge that I would somehow get through that despair and that we would make this happen. So it wasn't so much that I felt, or it wasn't only that I felt, well, I already love this child. It was also that I felt, I will love this child so much. And I thought, and if there's something wrong, that will be a locus of intimacy for us, as it has been for so many of these families, rather than a locus of disaffection and breakdown. And then at the end of 6 hours of going through all of this and being in a state of sort of panic and misery and anxiety and everything else, we went in to see the pediatrician, who said that the tests were all normal and that he was now extending his legs correctly. And when I asked her what she thought had been wrong in the morning, she said she thought he had probably had a cramp. So.
And now George is,
yes.
Is 4 and a half.
He is.
And you probably can't wait to get back home to see him.
It's true. I had a lovely bedtime phone call just before I came backstage, and it's
what book are you reading to him?
He's in a Winnie the Pooh phase, and I was a great Winnie the Pooh fan as a child, and my father used to do different voices for all the characters, and now I do all the different voices.
Are you
voices,
as good as that?
And so
he'll decide.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you. So let's open this up.
First of all, thank you. You've talked a lot about the vertical interaction. Could you just elaborate a little bit on the horizontal interaction and what this means to people that you've talked with?
One of the prime ideas of the book is that there are two kinds of identities. There are vertical identities that get handed down generationally. So one's ethnicity, one's nationality, usually one's language, often one's religion. These are things one has in common with one's parents. You can argue that some of those identities are very difficult, but nobody is trying to cure and address them. So you can say that it is harder in the United States, the current presidency notwithstanding, to be a person of color than it is to be a Caucasian, but nobody is trying to cure people so that the next generation of children born to Latinos or Asians or African Americans come out with blue eyes and blonde hair. But there are then what I've called horizontal identities, because identity is learned from a peer group. So being gay, being deaf, being autistic, these are all things that parents and children don't have in common, but parents tend to perceive them as illness or aberration of some kind, and then people find community in a peer group and come along to an identity definition of things. And time out of mind, people have attempted to cure all of the horizontal identities. And again, not to lapse into autobiography, but gayness is the one where it sort of seemed most clear to me that there was, until the horizontal community got to be very strong, you continue to have all of these parents who always wanted to fix the gayness of their children and were then very frustrated when they couldn't. And I ended up feeling that a lot of the topics I was writing about existed as what I called horizontal identities rather than vertical ones, and that there were particular dynamics around those horizontal identities.
I thought it was particularly interesting in the book the way you describe how you were dyslexic when you grew up, and you and your mother worked very hard at trying to, and solving that, curing that.
Right.
And then when you came out, it was obviously a different sort of model that you had to figure out.
Well, I think the problem, in a way, was I did have dyslexia when I applied to elementary schools. I was told by many schools that I would never learn to read or write. And I've had many problems in life, and that's not one of them. I feel like my mother worked with me very hard on coming up with strategies to compensate for the dyslexia. And if I inscribe anyone's book tonight and reverse the letters in your name, you'll know why, because it's still very difficult for me in writing by hand. But we worked very hard on the dyslexia and succeeded. And then I think it set the model for my mother's wish to somehow resolve this homosexuality and make it go away. And that was less successful. And it left me with the feeling that we really, you know, it's hard to understand what you can cure and what you can't. And I said in the book, and I believe it's firmly true, if the homosexuality had disappeared easily, but the dyslexia had been something I could never compensate for, I would have an identity as a dyslexic and not an identity as a gay person. Mm-hmm. So the things that are not changeable are the ones around which one forms an identity, by and large.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
On your right?
Yes.
Did your work on this book affect your feelings about abortion?
My work on this book included a great deal of thinking about abortion. It's a theme that comes up in chapter after chapter after chapter. One of the things that I urgently wanted to preserve was my belief that the decision to terminate a pregnancy rests squarely with the couple who have produced that pregnancy, and that I believe in unfettered access to abortion without a great deal of regulation about why you're having an abortion or any of the rest of it. So I wouldn't want the fact that I said some people who have brought up children with Down syndrome have loved bringing up those children to mean that other people have to do so. And I wouldn't want the fact that I said some people who have children conceived in rape have loved those children to mean that those people who have been raped don't have access to abortion. There should always, I think, be that access. What I hope that the book has perhaps done is to complicate the question in some people's minds, not of whether abortion should be legally allowed, because I think legally there's no basis for compromising the legality of abortion, but that it will perhaps cause people to think about it differently. And I've had several people who have written to me and said, I found out I was carrying a fetus with such and such a syndrome, and I was trying to decide whether or not to terminate, and I really didn't want to, and reading your book helped me to feel good about that decision. And I was glad to know that the book could have that effect. But as I say, I wouldn't ever want it to be taken as dictating what people should do. I sometimes feel as though there is the pro-choice movement, but often people make decisions in a vacuum. They have no idea what it would be like to have a child who is different in any of these ways. And I think, frankly, I mean, I don't know exactly where they would have stood on abortion, but if my parents had been able to avoid having a gay child in 1963, that was what they would have chosen. That's what pretty much everyone would have chosen in 1963. So I'm aware of having sort of survived because this was undetectable and there was nothing to be done about it at the time. But I'm aware that shifts could allow people to detect all kinds of things sooner and to make all kinds of decisions. I'd like the pro-choice movement to be more of a pro-informed choice movement in which people genuinely understand what kind of lives they're opting against. And then if they want to opt against them, I think they should have complete freedom to do so.
Thank you for that beautiful response, by the way. That was great.
Thanks.
I also wanted to thank you for the chapter on parents of prodigies. It's... And for talking about the concept of asynchronousness, you talk about gifted kids, and it's such a wrong terminology. Most of us would like to see it disappear, that asynchrony is really a far more informed concept for having a child who doesn't make sense with a lot of her kids and wants to spend time with all the adults as well. And the sort of the Bible of this movement, Living with Intensity, in the introduction, talks about redefining normal and how psychology, I'm trying to remember now, defines normal within a physics as opposed to a life sciences realm, and
right.
How if we would redefine what normal was, like how we redefine what middle class is, doesn't necessarily mean that what middle class is what is normal. It means, 1%, whatever, all that. And that redefining normal is such an important thing. So I just, I'm not sure. I guess my question is, what motivated you? Because it is such a different topic, and one personally, I've had a lot of people tell me they think I'm bragging when I talk about my daughter, and actually it's a concern. And when she was younger, there was questions around autism, and Temple Grandin was a big inspiration, and the spectrum from Asperger's to giftedness is it's a very muted line, and I'd love to hear more about that.
I had done an article for The New Yorker about the pianist Yevgeny Kissin, and when I did it, he was still, he was in his early 20s at that point and was sort of setting the world of classical music afire. And I wrote about the question of what is a prodigy and where does being a prodigy come from and so on and so forth. And then I didn't think about it terribly much after. I mean, I like music, and so I went to concerts and so on, but it wasn't a big focus. And I had started this book with the idea of all of these disability chapters and all of these difference chapters and so on. And I started working on the autism chapter, and I thought, Yevgeny Kissin has much in common with some of these people with higher functioning autism. And then I looked back at the prodigy research, and I looked at all of the problems, these questions of how to find a context that makes sense for these children. And I looked at the way that Yevgeny's parents had basically completely dissected their lives and given up almost everything else they had in order to nurture his talent, because it called on so much from them and required them to sacrifice so much in order to support it. And I suddenly kept seeing parallels, and I thought, okay, are these just parallels with Yevgeny Kissin, or are these parallels with the phenomenon altogether? And I'm interested in the world of music, and I go to a lot of concerts, and my stepmother works in the world of opera, and the more I thought about it, the more connected the situation seemed to be. And the more I felt that if part of what I was saying is, look, difference shouldn't always be so stigmatized, it would be good to look at a difference that in fact wasn't so stigmatized and see how it functioned. And I think you're right that the line between genius and madness is frequently a very delicate one. On the autism spectrum, in some of these other areas as well, there's someone who's... I interviewed for the book, who's an extremely well-known novelist who has a brother with schizophrenia, and she said he has the same imagination that I do. She said, but I know it's not real, and I write it down, and I've won these major literary awards, and he doesn't quite understand that it's not real, and so he lives in a permanently in a mental hospital. And the line came up over and over again in chapter after chapter after chapter.
Hi. First, I'd like to apologize to the audience and to you for making it distractible when I was taking notes. I felt a sense of shame and wanting to hide or run away, but I also wanted to stay and hear what you had to say. But I was wondering if, in your interviews, if you had that that kind of rapport where the parents or the family or even the individual himself or herself felt a sense of shame for their behavior and having to apologize or having or feeling like they needed to apologize for their behavior to the public, to the community in general.
There's no question that there is a sense of shame attached to many of these conditions. Shame is, of course, very tightly bound up with stigma, which we were talking about earlier. Wherever there's stigma, there is also shame. I came to understand a little bit of what that was, a little bit of what that was like in the course of being with people. I remember being with one family who had a very severely disabled child who had a lot of muscular spasms and who was confined to a wheelchair. And I went for a walk with them on the pier, actually in San Diego, and pushed the wheelchair. And I could feel people turning and staring at me. And there was a piece of me that felt like, here I am, I've engaged with all these differences, I'm helping these people, I'm going to tell their story. And there was another piece of me that thought, everyone is staring at me in a very uncomfortable way. And some of them were staring, most of them were staring with a kind of indulgent pity. It wasn't that they were staring and sort of shrieking obscenities at me or anything, or at her, or at sort of us as a group. But I was very aware of that. I remember going out to lunch with Clinton, the dwarf who's in the film, and we went into a restaurant in Midtown Manhattan that he had chosen near an office where he was working. And I mean, I could have gone in there with, I don't know, Madonna or with a ring-tailed lemur, and people couldn't have stared at me more than they did as we went through. And I felt those eyes on us, and I knew that almost everyone in the restaurant was going to go home and say, I was at lunch today, and there was this guy, he wasn't even 3 feet tall, who was there. You know, you could feel that it was an event in people's lives, and that focus could often be very difficult and very unpleasant. As one, actually, one of the dwarfs said to me, it's like being a celebrity when you haven't done anything and you haven't chosen it. And I experienced that sense of shame all over the place. You know, the area in which I think I was initially felt there was particularly a lot of shame was being transgender. I thought that felt very, still very forbidden and very shameful to me. I mean, the social conversation around being trans has changed enormously in the 11 years that I worked on the book. When I started working on it in 2001, things were very different. So, I ran into that shame all the time. I think shame is mostly not a very productive feeling. I think it's not very productive in most of these contexts. I'd like people to be ashamed of disemboweling someone's dog to let them know that they were going to destroy their child and not to be ashamed of who they really are. But the progress away from shame takes a lot of doing. And, you know, I'll say this kind of in closing on that, it's surprising to me that even after all these years and even after taking a public stance as a gay writer, I still will find myself in various contexts in which people will sort of say, oh, so tell me about your, you know, I don't know, I joined a gym when I was staying with my dad a while ago that was down the road from him in the country, and the guy said to me, oh, so you have a kid? What's that? And I thought, okay, I actually have a husband, and I sort of explained the whole thing. He was perfectly nice about it, but I was aware that there's still a piece of me that feels burdened by having to talk about that because there's still an element of thinking it's a little shameful and it's a little stigmatized and this person is going to have a moment of at least discomfort with it. So you never get away from that.
We have time for one more question. We're pushing the clock though, so make it a brief one, please.
To try to find some intersection between your two books, do you have any thoughts about the goth subculture as an expression or celebration of depression or as a tribe for functioning depressives?
I'm very interested in the overlap between my two books and can talk about that at great length. I'm not sure I have a huge amount to say about the goth subculture. I think there are people for whom goth subculture has allowed them to get over just what we were just discussing, some of the shame associated with depression, by finding a context in which their experience is not shameful, finding a context in which it is the generally accepted reality. And I think that's very liberating for people. I feel like the common theme of the two books is this business of being confronted with something that is evidently a severe adversity and seeking to find some kind of meaning or dignity in it, and how difficult it can be for people to do that, and how complicated it is for people to get to the point of saying, not depressions are wonderful, I'm so glad I had one, but given that I was stuck with the depression, how could I seek for or construct some kind of meaning out of it which would allow me, it will not prevent relapse, but it may make me better able to tolerate the prospect of relapse. How will I come to terms with the idea of myself as a person with depression? And I feel, how do these families come to terms with, and how do these individuals come to terms with being people with all of these conditions? My depression became something of an identity. You write a book about something, it's part of your identity. It was interesting to me as I considered all of this horizontal, vertical identity business to think, it's a piece of my identity. I very much hope that I will not have passed on to my own children. I hope that they never have to experience anything like it. If they do, I'll be better qualified than some people would have been to deal with it. But, I feel that one can construct a lot of meaning out of depression. And I think if we could get really acute depression, not sadness, but really acute, profound major depression out of the system, that would be a great advance.
Well, I think I can speak for us all and say that I'm grateful for your bringing these worlds to life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.